get some offensive rhythm. Houston now spinning, hunting. He gets two.
And I like that young man, Kyle Kuzma from Flint, Michigan.
Well, as we all know around here, there's only one Kuz in NBA history. That's Bob Cousy. But there were Kuz chants at the Staples Center last night. Lakers rookie Kyle Kuzma dropped 28 points, 17 in the fourth quarter, as the Lakers sent the Celtics to their fourth straight loss. LA wins 108-107 at Staples Center on Tuesday night. It's Wednesday, January 24th. I'm Chris Gasper. Welcome to Season Ticket. I'm joined now by Boston Globe sports columnist Dan Shaughnessy. We're going to talk some Celtics today and also some Patriots, but I got to start off here with the C's. Four straight losses for them, Dan. How concerned are you about this?
Well, aren't you glad they're happy with Jason Tatum? Imagine all the noise they'd be hearing. Why didn't they draft this guy? How'd this guy fall to 26 or 27?
Well, I will get to Jason Tatum because he's a big part of this four-game losing streak. But you're right, I don't want to take the line from you because you said this before we started doing the podcast, but Kyle Kuzma's been great as a rookie, and he's yet another guy who's better than who?
Better than Fultz.
Yeah, Danny's looking like a genius.
Right again. No, this is that's quite a game. I know not everybody was staying up late for this one.
I did.
It's a tall task. Good for you. And, Celtics-Lakers always has a good part of a draw. Hey, they were not going to win 65 games. I think that, early projections a little bit crazy with that long, long winning streak they had after losing the first two. And coming back to reality a little bit, this is interesting that they had those cheesy losses to not good teams before this trip. I mean, your Philly thing, your Orlando thing, that's what kind of tees up this trip and makes it a little bit alarming because with, back-to-back tonight in L.A., and then you got the Warriors, and then at Denver, you could really string together quite a little losing streak before you get home.
It's a good point, and you mentioned back-to-back. This is back-to-back losses to the Orlando Magic and the Los Angeles Lakers, two teams that are not anywhere near the playoffs, and I think that's what's concerning here for the Celtics. You look at this game, they were pounded, on the boards. Once again, the Lakers had 14 offensive rebounds. The Celtics only had seven. They could not keep Julius Randle off the offensive glass. As I mentioned, Kuzma went crazy in the fourth quarter. Big game from Kyrie Irving, 33 points, but he just didn't get a lot of help, and that's sort of been something that has been a consistent theme during this losing streak, Dan. And one guy who's disappeared a little bit, not just during the four games, but over the last nine games, you mentioned him, Jason Tatum. Yeah. Tatum, over the last nine games, he's only shooting 39% from the field, 34.5% from three-point range, averaging about 10 points per game. His season averages are 13.5 points per game, 48.8% from the field, and 44.9% from three. Is he hitting the rookie wall?
Well, I was going to say, nobody wants to give him back. Let's not take this too far here. But all that said, sure, I think that's the proverbial rookie wall that you referenced there. And again, he's at a point now, you're looking at 34, 40, they played like almost 48 games, whatever it is. So the college season's over in terms of games played. And they're way past that. This is happening. I think even Ball, before he got hurt, his legs were giving out. Guys, in that league just aren't used to it. They come out, they're 19, they're 20 years old. This is a tall order. And sometimes you don't pace yourself the way they do. And, young guys hate to pace themselves because it looks like you're dogging it. And they can't really rationalize that. But when you're a jumping jack out there the whole time you're on the floor, that's not really the NBA way. And you look at the veterans, a lot of them know when to put it into cruise control and not do so much or try to do so much. So every chance, that's what's happening with Tatum. You don't hold it against him. But this was going to happen to this team because they were not going to win, like I said, 65 games, and here we are.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. I mean, I think that they are still the best team in the East, but this is a little bit of water finding its level here. And these are not losses you want to have, Philadelphia, New Orleans, Orlando, the Lakers, particularly the last two. But the reality is that people like Tatum and Jaylen Brown, I think, were, I don't say playing above their heads, but I think it developed faster than people anticipated, particularly after the Gordon Hayward injury. And I also think when you look at it, and our good pal Gary Washburn and colleague wrote about this the other day, Danny has to fix the bench.
Yeah.
He still hasn't fixed the bench. There's not enough scoring there. And even though it was good last night with Marcus Smart, I don't know about you, but in terms of watching that game and the last shot the Celtics took.
Time left. Smart across half court. Behind the back. Room to grow. Oh, and off. But left.
I don't care that Marcus Smart had 22 points on the night and had shot the ball. I don't want him taking that
probably
shot.
Probably not.
I don't. No, I just don't. Don't take that
hoisting
shot.
Hoisting it up.
Pass it to Kyrie Irving.
Yeah.
Terry Rozier had made some key shots down the stretch of that game, a big three and a nice drive. He was wide open on the wing. Like, I admire the competitiveness of Marcus Smart, but what frustrates me about him is that I feel like he just doesn't know his role in the NBA. He doesn't accept his role. The guy's a role player. He you know, not, stop trying to be a hero.
He didn't go to the Bill Parcells school as know who you are. This is who you are. Don't be somebody you're not. That's what you see when you're seeing that kind of hoisting up at the end. And I think when you reference the rebounding, Chris, that was an issue last year. It's been an issue when they lose games. It sometimes is an issue at the end of games, and they have not addressed that. The rebounding and the bench are the two things this team needs to do better at. And it's on Danny. He's got that exemption. He can go get another player. There's money to spend there, and I think that he will.
Yeah, I think he will, too. It's interesting. Who will he bring in? You know, you hear these names like Tyreke Evans is a guy who's been connected to the Celtics, Marco Bellinelli down in Atlanta. They could use that veteran presence. This Jarrell Eddie kid on the 10-day contract, who's basically just roster fodder, that's not quite going to get it done. He got about 4 minutes of playing time last night.
Can we get Jeff Green back again?
Yeah, well, Jeff Green. Well, I'm glad you mentioned Jeff Green.
Guy.
Jeff Green is on the Cleveland Cavaliers, and that's another subplot of the Celtics' four-game losing streak here, is they have a real opportunity to bury the Cleveland Cavaliers, and they have not taken advantage of it. There's a lot of acrimony, a lot of turmoil in Cleveland, in LeBron land. You have guys calling out other guys. Kevin Love getting called out by his teammates for leaving a game against the Oklahoma City Thunder sick. Apparently, one of the people calling him out, according to reports, was former Celtic Isaiah Thomas, who's been on the team for about 20 seconds, and also doesn't seem like he's endeared himself to one LeBron James so far.
No, that thing is just a bleep show, as you say, at this point, because I watched the game on Saturday when they gave up 1,000 points.
148.
Oklahoma City. It was like watching the old Doug Moe NBA in the 80s. I'm like, what is going
on
here?
That's right, the old Nuggets.
And it's just it looks dysfunctional. It looks to me like they need to fire the coach. I'm sorry. LeBron is the coach. Make LeBron player coach if you have to. Put it on him like Bill Russell back in the day. I would do that. Isaiah's defense, that's going to shine. You're going to see a problem there. It's a problem. But guys like Tristan Thompson and Korver, you know, Rose, they just look done.
They look old, right?
Done to me.
Too much mileage.
And I don't know where this is going. They're always going to be a threat when you get to the conference playoffs. And right now, they're going to be seated in the middle. They have almost as many losses as the Sixers do at this point. They are absolutely in free fall. The coaching situation, they're all mad at Love. There's chaos in Cleveland. We'll see where it goes. You still take them seriously come playoff time. They're still a factor in the Eastern Conference, as is Toronto. And in my view, Washington, forever a team the Celtics have trouble matching up with.
Yeah, just looking at the standings in the NBA today. So you mentioned the Cavaliers. They have 27 wins. LeBron's old team, the team he left, the Miami Heat, they're 27-20. Cavs 27-19. I don't think that's the way LeBron really drew it up. The Cavaliers have lost 10 of 13. Are you concerned at all, though, with the Celtics in terms of they could really bury the Cavaliers here? And I know Toronto's only a game and a half behind, and I should probably give Toronto more respect, but honestly, I'm not worried about them. It's Cleveland I'm worried about, and you have a chance to absolutely bury them, not let them get anywhere near home court in the playoffs, and that was a big deciding factor last year. I thought, even though the Celtics were the number one seed, having to go to Cleveland in that situation, I thought, was difficult for them. You can absolutely bury this team.
You know what? Be careful what you wish for. This might be the unintended consequence of this might be getting Cleveland in an earlier round.
Good point.
I mean, not a team you want to be seeing in the first round out of the gate. If you're one and they're eight, well, that's not. But second round, a real possibility now, given what we're talking about. And who wants to bow out in the second round because you came against a Cleveland team that has beaten the Warriors in the NBA Finals? They have all these veterans. They get it together at the end. Be careful about that.
Yeah, I have to be honest. So I'm still afraid of them, and I think that's why I'm frustrated that the Celtics haven't put more distance between themselves and the Cavaliers and really sort of sent the message there, because the Cavaliers right now look like a fragile team. The Celtics don't look like a fragile team, but they do look like a flawed one.
Absolutely. And again, people got too high and mighty about how good they were early on, the 16-game winning streak, all that stuff. They are not the best team in the NBA. They are not the best team in the Eastern Conference by acclamation. They might be by the time the playoffs move forward, but we don't know that right now, and it's still ahead of them.
So speaking of the Celtics and what's ahead of them, one thing that could be ahead of them is a return of Gordon Hayward. The last time we saw him on a basketball court, it was pretty gruesome as he broke his ankle in the season opener against the Cleveland Cavaliers out in Cleveland. He's on this road trip with the Celtics. He does have a home in San Diego. Celtics coach Brad Stevens didn't want to give any indication that this meant that Gordon Hayward was closer to a return. The fact he was on this road trip for the first time, he's shooting threes, standing up, and all that good stuff. I honestly think the Celtics are sandbagging us with this Hayward. He's coming back.
Wow. And
I think he's in the plans.
Okay. I don't care one way or the other. It would be a great story. It'd be really fun to watch. I'm just emotionally, I think it's a mistake to bank on him being a factor in the postseason for them. I just think it's asking too much of the physical stress that you have to do coming off that injury. I'd rather see him have a summer and be able to do all the things. I would be nervous watching him. I was there the night it happened in Cleveland, and you say to yourself, we're not going to see this guy again this year. If we do, good for him, good for them. I just have a hard time banking on it, and I think the Celtics are right to sandbag. If they do have this plan, keep it quiet. Keep it to yourself.
Well, I think here's the reason they do it, Dan, because you don't want to put any pressure on him. One, I think he wants to come back more than anybody else.
Do.
I think that they're holding him back. I think he's the one who's pushing it, pushing it, pushing it. But I think what you do, you don't want to put any public pressure on him and say, oh, he's definitely coming back. If you act the whole time like you don't expect to have the guy back and he sort of miraculously, air quotes, comes back, then it looks great. If you say he's coming back, and they learned their lesson, I think, a couple years ago. Remember with Shaquille O'Neal when they traded Kendrick Perkins? It was like, oh, Shaq's going to be back. Shaq's going to be back. And every time there was some sort of injury, there was some sort of setback, some sort of delay. And, you know, when Shaq finally did come back, he was a shell of himself.
He was on a forklift when they brought him back.
Yeah. Well, he was doing a lot of lifting of the fork by the time he came back
because
he was way overweight. So they've been down this road before, and people were upset with Shaq, and they were upset with Danny Ainge, and they sort of ridiculed Danny for how could you rely on this guy. So if they don't say publicly that this guy, Gordon Hayward, is in their plans, it works for them, and I think it works for Hayward. But it's January 24th. I mean, we have 2.5 months left in the season. This guy's shooting threes, standing up, and traveling on road trips. You're telling me he's not going to come back?
I'm still saying it's a possibility he doesn't come back, and I hope he doesn't.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, obviously, they should take precautions. They shouldn't push him. They shouldn't rush him. They might have to slow him down for his own good, but I think he's coming back, and I think that factors into the Celtics' plans. I think we'll know more about that, too, as we get closer to that February 8th trade deadline, Dan. What kind of player do they get? Because if they feel like Gordon Hayward's coming back as a rotational piece, maybe you don't quite need the same caliber of player as a trade acquisition that you would need before. All right, we're going to take a brief time out here on Season Ticket. When we come back, we're going to switch things up and talk about the New England Patriots. They're only in the Super Bowl again. So we'll get Dan's thoughts on whether the Philadelphia Eagles qualify as tomato cans or a real opponent. Stay tuned for that. Welcome back. If you like Season Ticket, subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Remember, subscribing is the best way to make sure you get our latest episode as soon as it's available. I'm back now with Dan Shaughnessy, and we're on to Minneapolis in Super Bowl 52, the Patriots' opponent, the Philadelphia Eagles. Not an opponent that really the Patriots know a lot about, Dan. When you look at this, first question for you, what you know about the Eagles, and I'm not expecting you to break it down like Tony Romo, but do you think this is a real team, given the fact that they have their backup quarterback in Nick Foles, and the Patriots' road to a sixth Super Bowl goes through Marcus Mariota, Blake Bortles, and Nick Foles?
Well, I mean, obviously Carson Wentz, you know, he was on his way to an MVP season. He gets hurt in December. Really a tough break for the Eagles. That's why they end up being underdogs at home in the NFC Championship, that kind of thing. But I think in the field of you know, bad quarterbacks in the Final Four, in Blake Bortles, who did well last weekend,
well.
We know
yeah.
he did well, did what he could do. Case Keenum, Nick Foles, and Tom Brady was the whole what's wrong with this picture kind of thing. I think Foles of the other three is certainly more respectable, whatever you want to call it, than the other two guys were. More of a chance, puncher's chance, to give you a game-managing situation in a Super Bowl like Hostetler did for the Giants.
Yes.
The famed Trent Dilfer is always referenced with Baltimore, and this guy could be that guy because he's not a kid. He's been out there enough, and there's an argument that he could be a starter on other teams, and I think you don't get that with a lot of these guys who wound up in the thing. So, and obviously he lit it up in the NFC Championship, had those great numbers. I just if I'm the Eagles, I'm worried about Bill Belichick devouring a guy that's just not prepared for the moment. And I think Belichick, no one does it better than Bill Belichick against inexperienced or guys with not great resumes coming into a game like this.
Yeah, you mentioned Foles lighting it up in the NFC Championship game against the Minnesota Vikings. He's lit it up in the playoffs. He's completing about 78% of his passes, 3 touchdowns, no picks. And I agree, if there's anybody who knows you can win a Super Bowl with a backup quarterback, it's Bill Belichick. You referenced it, that Giants team, similar situation to the Eagles in 1990. Phil Simms goes down, Jeff Hostetler steps in, and they still end up winning the Super Bowl. He won his first Super Bowl here in New England with a backup quarterback by the name of Tom Brady. If people remember that, you referenced Trent Dilfer. Guys like Brad Johnson have won a Super Bowl. So there are quarterbacks less equipped than Nick Foles, who have won a Super Bowl. On the other hand, though, I can't help but look at it, Dan, and just think, man, the football universe just bends to Belichick's will. Like, Nick Foles? Nick Foles? And I'll be honest with you, I think Philadelphia is a good team, but if the Patriots were to lose this Super Bowl to the Eagles, I think it would be a worse loss than the Super Bowl 42 loss to the Giants.
I understand what you're saying, although, you know, the undefeated. Are you talking about the undefeated team or the Indianapolis
game? I'm talking about the undefeated.
Well, I don't know. Then I would disagree with you. No one's going to ever say that. That would be a ridiculous comment. You should not make that comment.
I can make that comment.
It cannot be worse than an undefeated team.
They played the Giants during the regular season, the last
38,
game. The Giants gave them a real game.
I know, yes.
Yeah, so we knew the Giants could go toe-to-toe with them. You think the Nick Foles Eagles are set up to go toe-to-toe?
I think that what you're saying, just because of the hyperbole around the undefeated season, no one was prepared for that, although those who knew football, and you were the beat guy on that team.
I was the beat guy.
You could sort of see it coming because you were in the Meadowlands 3 weeks before and you saw the competitive
game. They barely beat them.
And all that stuff. There was that stuff. But around the country, the idea of the Patriots losing that game was just not to be believed.
Sure,
game is kind of a 5.5-point spread, whatever it is, a little bit more up for grabs, and it won't carry the kind of shock and awe and disgrace that game had.
Yes, and that's true. Look, there's a historical component there from the idea of you lost the undefeated season, and I understand what you're saying. But what I'm saying from a pure matchup standpoint,
right. Okay.
You know, that team, the Giants team was hot. You know, they had Michael Strahan, and they had Plaxico Burress, and they had Eli Manning. Like, they had some name guys.
Yep.
You look at the Eagles love being in this underdog role, but you look at their team, and they've had a great season. They were the number one seed in the NFC, but it's Nick Foles with Alshon Jeffrey, who's a good receiver. I mean, their leading receiver was the tight end, Zach Ertz. That was their leading receiver this year. So I'm not disparaging them. I just think when you look at it, this whole thing has been teed up for the Patriots, and it would be very, very disappointing if they lost the opportunity for a sixth Super Bowl title to this team with Nick Foles at quarterback. That's just the way I feel
about
it.
Fair enough.
That's the way I feel.
I'll second that emotion.
So let me ask you, though, the big thing with Philadelphia, and I wasn't at the first Philadelphia Super Bowl. I know you were, Super Bowl 39 in Jacksonville.
One of the worst weeks of my life. I was there.
Why was it one of the worst weeks?
Because it was in Jacksonville, and it was the Eagle fans were there. Two bad things. Jacksonville should not have a Super Bowl, and Eagle fans should not be allowed to leave home.
What's the issue with Eagle fans?
They're just tough. They had to put Crisco oil on the light poles last weekend so they wouldn't climb the poles after they won that game.
Some guy still ran into a pole, by the way.
The police were out there doing that. You know, the whole thing, we have a nice piece in the Globe today about the legend of booing Santa Claus. I called Terry Francona, and I'll have a column out. It should be online by the time you hear this podcast. But, you know, Tito managed 4 years in Philadelphia, 8 years here, so he understands the fan bases in both places. And even he admits it's a little different there. I mean, they slashed his tires there. They had to change where he parked his car every day. He had this great story. When he won with the Red Sox, he was driving to Florida, 2005, spring training, I-95, and he passes it to the border, and he sees all these Philadelphia double wides and, you know, SUVs festooned with flags of Eagles. It's coming north. They were all leaving Jacksonville, driving back up, having lost the Super Bowl to the Patriots right at the same time. And Tito said, I started flipping them off out the window. I saw all these Eagle fans going by. So I was like, this was my revenge. He said when he went back, he worked with a camera guy just as a lark to go cover a Niners-Eagles NFL game in the early part of the century. It had been years since he had managed in Philly. He wasn't yet manager of the Red Sox. He's just in the end zone helping the guy with equipment. And he says, I start hearing this chant, and it's Tito sucks, Tito sucks. And he says the players came over, and they said, are they talking about Terrell Owens or you? He says, no, I think it's me.
It was not T.O., it's Tito.
They hadn't forgot Terry Francona all those years later, and at a football game, he was getting a chant from the end zone.
Probably the most embittered fans in America. What else did Tito have to say about sort of the difference? Because we like to fancy ourselves here in Boston as a very critical fan base. I'm sure it's not as critical as it used to be, and you've written about that in the past. But what is it about the Philadelphia sports fan where they are just in a situation where it's not only sort of misery, which we can all feel in sports, but there's a real indignation and anger when it comes to their teams and following their teams.
A lot of anger. And again, it's festered because they haven't won. Now, they did have the Phillies thing happen. That was nice.
Yeah, 2008.
A decade ago.
But
the Eagles have never won a Super Bowl. That really sticks with them. And they travel well. They will dominate the population when we get to Minnesota. There'll be way more Eagle fans than Patriot fans. This will be one time that you're going to be outnumbered. Watch out.
Did Tito say anything about them throwing batteries? Because they're sort of notorious.
No, there were no batteries.
Okay.
No, he said he was more just, his team was bad when he managed in Philadelphia, and that kind of made it harder for him than managing here. As bad as things could get here, and he had some moments here, the team was good. He did not have that in Philly, and he heard the wrath.
While I have you on a roll, you mentioned Jack, one of the worst weeks of your life in Jacksonville.
I went and looked at my lead paragraph when I got down to Jacksonville, and I said, here's my advice to all you Patriot fans. Buy the plasma television, stay home, and don't come down here to this game.
How do you feel about Minneapolis?
You know what? I like Minneapolis, and I like downtown. I'm not wild about the prospect of a week at the Mall of America.
Yes, that's where all the media stuff will be, in the media center. Radio Row, for the fans who don't know, people listening, it's all going to be at the Mall of America in Bloomington, and the teams are staying out by there.
I don't understand what happened to downtown Minneapolis. It's not that small. Downtown Indianapolis, we were there in 2011-12.
That was great.
And they accommodated. It's a little place, but everybody was downtown. You want a city where everybody's in the same place, like New Orleans does that, and you're all together, and the fans can fight with each other and see each other, instead of these spread out places. And this Minneapolis thing, like, they had the baseball All-Star game there like 3 or 4 years ago, and I realized this thing is 20 times bigger. But they do have a downtown and hotels, and they are bigger than Indianapolis, which managed to be the host city of the Super Bowl and not send everybody to the outskirts to nuclear test sites and, you know, Area B or whatever like that. So I'm a little bit hesitant going into this thing.
I'm a little nervous because I feel like I'm going to be competing for space with older folks who are power walking through that mall in the morning. So I'm a little worried. I'm a little worried about that, you know, getting run over by some power walkers. If there's one thing I know about the Super Bowl, one tradition, what did they say? The Masters, a tradition unlike any other. It's media members complaining about the logistics and accommodations at the Super Bowl. But I'm in agreement with you. I don't understand why we're spending a week at a mall. Getting back to the game here, sort of. What do you make of this jersey thing? So the Patriots are the home team here, but they've elected to wear their white away jerseys. Those are the jerseys they've worn against Atlanta last year in the great comeback. In Super Bowl 49, they were wearing white. They're 3-1 all time in white, but the Belichick-Brady era, they're 3-0. They've never lost in the white jerseys. Normally, I would poo-poo this, but I feel like this is the type of thing that Bill would somehow be aware of, or someone would make him aware of it, and he would. No stone is left unturned by Bill Belichick.
Sure, I think they got the choice in this, which is, you know, and they made a choice. It's kind of like deferring a kickoff. It's a little bit of a thing, but they know what they want to do. And I think given the track record, why not keep a good thing going? We know they had them last year. You want to keep that going. I'm looking at this. Did they have him against Seattle, the one?
Yes.
I think, oh, well, there you go. Yeah. I mean, how could you deviate from that? If you had a choice in your last two, and that's the memory of your last two, of course you're going to stay with that.
Yeah. So they're going with those jerseys, so we know that. Again, this is the type of thing that becomes a story in the week before the Super Bowl, because there's a little bit of dead time here. But that makes it fun, because we can have sort of debates like this. Who is more important in the grand scheme of the Patriots dynasty, Dan Shaughnessy? Is it Bill Belichick or Tom Brady? And the reason I ask this is that there's a story that came out with Sports Illustrated in which Jay Feely, who attended Michigan with Brady, told Greg Bishop, the SI reporter, that Gisele Bündchen wanted him to convince Brady to retire last offseason. And when we look at this season with the Patriots, there's been some discord down there in Foxborough, some friction, and it feels like a lot of it has to do with egos and sort of jostling for who is going to have the highest platform on the medal stand of history, for who is most responsible for this Patriots dynasty, Bill Belichick or Tom Brady?
Well, I mean, obviously that's a loaded question, because no matter what you say, there's a lot of blowback on it. I'm in the Belichick camp at this moment, and no one's been a better quarterback than Tom Brady. I just, when I see these games on a week-to-week basis, and as I get older, and as this thing goes on, the disparity is greater at that position than it is at the quarterback position, from what I can see. I mean, Drew Brees can come in and have a game with Tom Brady if he's matched up. But these coaches, it's like they all wet their pants when they see Bill Belichick. They all make stupid decisions. They lose their football acumen. It is psychological. It is tactical. It is strategic. It is preparation. It is experience. All those things. And the gap is wider than ever. Everyone in the NFL is a stooge except for Belichick, and it gives you an advantage, and it's why they'll win this game as well. So I'm going with the coach in this one.
So Bill had the perfect play drawn up. 3rd and 18. That was Bill.
Yes.
That wasn't the throw.
No, it's all him.
It's all him. Yeah, I disagree. I think it's Brady. I think when you look at it, you know, Bill's a great coach. I think one of the biggest myths is that somehow he got so much better from Cleveland to New England. I think he was a great coach in Cleveland. His quarterback was Vinny Testaverde. He won one playoff game.
The flip side of that is when the year Brady's out, they win 11 games with Matt Castle.
But they didn't make the playoffs, and there was a 5-game drop-off from the year before with Brady, largely the same team. So you can look at it. 11 wins is great, but
Jacoby Brissett, they win. 5-game
drop-off.
They win.
No, that was and I thought the big winner of Deflategate was Bill.
Yeah.
There's no doubt he's a great coach. I mean, there's no question about it. But I just think the quarterback is that little extra that puts you over the top where you're at talking about five or six Super Bowls. I mean, how many times are we going to see these comebacks?
There is no right or wrong answer to this
question.
No,
there's not. It's one of the all-time great debates. But I do think – do you think overall that that's sort of what we're getting to at this point? That's one of the subplots here as – I don't want to say the Patriots dynasty winds down, but as we get to really unprecedented heights, I mean, you're talking about an eighth Super Bowl for these guys, winning a sixth Super Bowl together, and everything that they've accomplished. And just given what's gone on this year, it seems like that's sort of the subtext here, that you have two guys who both probably feel they are the most responsible for this. I mean, it's one of the great unions in sports history.
Yeah, and there's a little bit of an edge creeping into it now in the, on the wake of the ESPN story about who doesn't like who and what's going on here. And right through last weekend when Brady has the bandage, goes out there with the stitches, has that game, and when Bill keeps getting pressed about, you know, the Audie Murphy, heroic Willis Reed aspects of Tom's performance, he finally says, hey, it's not like the guy had open heart surgery. So, you know, it appears like they're starting to you know, dig in a little bit on their respective sides in this. And now you got this notion that Brady might retire after the game. That's gaining some steam. That'll be a big thing for the next 10 or 12 days.
Oh, man. Well, if he retires
that
after
this
game. That
would be totally screwing Bill Belichick.
Absolutely, because Garoppolo's not there anymore. Then they should have held on to Garoppolo. Can you imagine that? Poor Bill.
Yeah.
If that goes down. I mean, Bill had it all lined up. I still don't understand why they didn't just franchise Garoppolo. But, yeah, if Giselle or somebody else convinces
that would
Brady
be Tom's
to retire.
Revenge if they really are hard feelings right there.
Are you
there.
Kidding me? If they retired,
sweet.
That would be unbelievable. So, yeah, really interesting. I mean, that's one. That's an evergreen one. We can always talk about that, who's sort of more responsible. I think the reality is it's a great debate, but the two guys need each other. Neither one of them would have five Super Bowl rings. And I know, look, Bill has more from his Giants days, but five with the Patriots if they weren't together. And I think that's one of those things where you're together so long and somebody wants to say, I'm more responsible. No, I'm more responsible. It doesn't matter. You're winning. That's all that matters is that you won. It doesn't matter who gets the credit, right? Isn't that the Patriot way? It doesn't matter who gets the credit?
It's supposed to be. Yes, it is.
I agree. All right. Dan, I look forward to your column with Terry Francona. We would be remiss here on Season Ticket if we didn't mention that there's a new acquisition in the Shaughnessy family. Congratulations, Grandpa.
Oh, thank you, Chris. Yes, Kate Shaughnessy and her husband, Rob Greenfield. They welcomed Matthew Greenfield into the world this morning at 5:03 a.m. at Newton Wellesley Hospital. And he's weighing in at 10 pounds, 1 ounce, so it's a big fella. See how that goes.
Might be an offensive lineman, Nate Solder's replacement, possibly. And this is grandchild number?
Number 3 boys. Thank you.
Excellent. Yep, 3 boys. Fantastic. Dan, as always, thanks for coming on Season Ticket.
Thanks, Chris.
That's it for this edition of Season Ticket, a production of the Boston Globe and WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. If you enjoyed the show, please tell a friend and leave us a review. I'm Chris Gasper. We'll catch you tomorrow.